Welcome to Ujiria, broadcasting live from Business Radio X Studios. Ujiria is a Greek word meaning health of body and mind in aging individuals. Ujiria Radio is a weekly show celebrating the heroes that contribute to the Ujiria of our elderly and disabled population. Now joining us in the studio are your hosts, Sam Grass and Brad Culp.
Good morning. This is Sam Grass in Atlanta, Georgia. Today is January the 5th, 2011, our first broadcast of the new year. Joining me today in the studio is Lee Cantor, our producer of the show. Good morning, Lee. How are you?
Good. Everything's good over here, Brad. Brad, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I thought he said Lee. So.
He did, but I wanted to make sure I didn't hear you for a second. I got nervous. Sorry, my bad.
Right out of the box, we have a little technical difficulty, but we've worked it through. How are you, Brad? Joining us in Dallas, Texas is Brad Culp. Brad, take it away.
Good morning, and welcome this morning. Welcome to 2011. Happy New Year, everybody. We've got a full house this morning, so we're going to not bore you with trivia. We have three guests this morning. We have two from Life Languages Institute, Fred Kendall and Richard Brown. And from Senior Focused Relocations, we have Sherry Ingalls. So we're going to start this morning with Fred and Richard. Fred Kendall is the president and founder of Life Languages Institute, and Richard Brown has joined Fred more recently after a full career in another area that I'll let him talk about. But Richard's role is, and I'll again let him talk about it, to help promote Life Languages and help them grow. So, good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning. To be with you.
Good morning.
Fred, let's start with you. If you could just give us a little background on yourself, where'd you grow up, where'd you go to school, and, how did you end up founding Life Languages Institute?
Well, I grew up in a rural area of New Mexico, in Lincoln County, New Mexico, home of Smokey the Bear and the White Mountain ski area and the Ridosa Downs and just a lot of other things. And my dad was very entrepreneurial, plus he was a deputy sheriff for 41 years in McKinney. And during that period of time, I was raised in a Christian environment, which put a lot of emphasis on being available to help whoever needed help. And from there, I went to New Mexico Military Institute for 2 years and got an associate's degree in military science, and then from there to University of New Mexico, and I got a degree in psychology. And from there, I went to University of California after working a year at the probation department in Alameda County, Old California. And I stayed continuing working there, but then went to University of California, Berkeley for a semester of grad work in psychology. And then I stayed there at the probation department another 2 years, and during that time I went to University of California Law School a year. And by that time I had been involved for a while in the United States Marine Corps Reserves, and I got called up for active duty and was in the Marine Corps then a combination of reserve and active duty time of 11 and a half years. And I was an infantry officer during that time. Shows I'm very bright. Only a few can get in the infantry. You got to be able to walk. Doesn't help hurt if you can talk some, not too much though. So then when I got married, and I hadn't been married very long until my wife was in rebellion against the authority of myself. You know, I was commander-in-chief of the universe, she used to proclaim, and I was trying to help her shape up to become all that she could be. Then with our son, I began to try to help him be all that he could be, teaching the art of hand-to-hand combat. And after I'd been married 6 years, she filed for divorce. And during that period of time, though I was raised in a Christian family, I had never been overly committed or zealous about anything of the Lord, nor had I ever read the Bible much, because it made me sleepy. So I had an experience with the Lord while separated from her. I was living in California, and she was in Texas, Houston, Texas. And the Lord just spoke to me that if I didn't work to save my wife and our son for his purposes, that there's no telling where they would go, because by this time my wife had become an alcoholic, which if she was here, she would tell you that. And she also had begun to develop friends that when I was out and about, Gradually, when I was even in town, she would go out with her friends, and I never liked any of her boyfriends. So it just became a desperate struggle to try to save my marriage, and that's probably the best thing that's ever happened to me is that anguish of having a horrible marriage. My son wrote me a note, said he hated me and Mama hates you, and we both wished you were dead. And that's a clue you're not necessarily succeeding as a father and a husband. And I just thought the Lord impressed upon me that if I would, in His Word, and scripturalize everything that I'd learned academically and militarily, because at the time I had been selected to be a major, and so I had a lot of military training, and have gone to a lot of different kinds of military schools and training experiences, and He just showed me that nobody on this earth was my enemy but the devil, and I needed to quit fighting everybody else, because I was always slight and small for my size, so small for my age is a better way to say it, and my dad was a little larger, so I grew up always trying to prove I was tough. And very insecure, and the way I overcame insecurity was there's hardly anybody any size that I couldn't whip if given a chance. And I was always ready to fight, and that's why I went to the Marine Corps. That's why I went to a military school. And that's why I got into martial arts and jiu-jitsu. But sum it all up, after 3 years, my marriage was restored. And I've been married now 45 years. Got the most beautiful, virtuous, godly, awesome wife in the world. Red-headed, everybody adores her, and many people like me, and everybody adores her. And I'm often known as Mr. Annie Kendall, and I just delight in that. And while I was separated from her, I began to think about what she was always telling me. And what she frequently told me is, do you ever consider other people's feelings before you act and do the stupid things you do? And I got to thinking, do I think? And I thought, well, you know, I'm pretty reactive. And I got to thinking, am I concerned about people's feelings? Not really. You know, most of them are emotional, over-emotionalized. And I had a term back then that people need to stop going EPA. And I still use that term. And that is they should stop emotionalizing, personalizing, and adrenalizing, and just get about the business of whatever it was. So I had low tolerance, and I had high expectations, and I had disappointed expectations, so I had a lot of resentment. I had a lot of anger. And over a period of time, the Lord removed all that, and I reconciled my wife. But the way I did it is I began to think about her and our son. Our son had already memorized some Bible and a lot of scriptures, and he also had memorized Jesus Christ Superstar, and lots of other things, and he wasn't good at instant obedience, and I believe in I.O., instant obedience, because otherwise, you know, you might die if you don't jump when I tell you to. So I got to thinking about him, and I thought, you know, he doesn't like you, and he only likes people who are very bright. So I began to try to treat him as though I were bright and he was bright, intellectually. And we'd already been told that he was probably a genius. So then I began thinking, my wife, she's very relational. She likes to hug, and everybody's her friend. She's always agreeing to go to lunch with anybody and everybody, even though there's no possibility of it happening. And I always consider that as a form of, I don't know how to describe it, but like, you know, fraud. You know, she knew she couldn't do that. And I'd tell her that, and maybe in front of other people. So I began to treat her as though she was very emotive, our son very cognitive. And I realized I was very kinetic, very action-oriented. And so as I began to treat her with emotional sensitivity and extend grace and mercy to her and love to her and unconditional acceptance to her and agape love to her and stop demanding that she learn how to load a dishwasher and stop telling her, you know, who cleaned this house, a drunk or a blind person? Who loaded this dishwasher? You know, was it somebody autistic? And, you know, so I stopped saying those things, and I began to be her servant. So for now, over 30 years, I have served her breakfast in bed every morning, because that's one of the things that I demanded, that she get up and cook up the breakfast, because that's how a good man deserves. So I've been serving her breakfast in bed for over 30 years, did this morning.
I'm going to have to tell my wife not to listen to the show.
Yes. I began to be everything I could be to my son. I asked the Lord to show me See, the Marine Corps teaches you one thing. If you can't do things that you expect others to do nearly as well as them, they're not going to respect you. They probably won't follow you. They also teach you, if you don't demonstrate, you'll be a servant to them, so to speak. So one of the first things you often do as an infantry officer is you take your unit on a march for 3.5 miles or so with transport packs, and you stop halfway and have each person wash the other person's feet and then help them put their dry socks on. Hmm. And as an infantry officer, you know, I'd wash somebody's feet, dry their feet, put their socks on for them, then they'd wash my feet. So I began to see that, you know, and in the Marine Corps, the infantry officers or officers in the Marine Corps all eat last when you're in the field or in combat, and go to bed last when you're in the field or in combat. Get up first if you're in the field or combat. So I began to just say, well, I'm going to do these same things at home for my wife and son. So I became their servant. The Marine Corps also teaches you, if the men don't believe you'll die for them, remember they're marching behind you oftentimes, and all 44 of them have weapons with bullets. They just might shoot you in the back some dark night in the jungle. And, you know, that didn't happen in Vietnam. Marines ever did that to each other. Surely not. But maybe. But anyway, so I began to ask the Lord to show me how I could demonstrate to my wife and son I'd die for them. And gradually over a period of time, that began to take place with them. One thing, my son got out in the middle of the lake one time, thought he was about to drown, so I was able to swim out and save him, even though I'm a bad swimmer. So God is good. He's faithful. And that's who I sought to follow. And we started Life Language Institute for the purpose of helping people to understand that there are 56 character qualities that are commands in the New Testament. And if you know those 56 character qualities, and there's one for each of the seven languages. I mean, there's seven for each of the seven languages, seven life languages, and there is seven that are universal for everybody. And we began to develop this concept that people are kinetic, emotive, or they're cognitive, but that they are all three, in fact. They just lean towards one. And like our son has proven, very cognitive. You know, he taught foreign languages at the University of North Texas. He taught Greek. Not Greek, Cherokee, Gaelic Irish, and Spanish, and Russian. And in the Army, he was an interpreter and interrogator in Spanish and Russian. Well, I've never learned to speak English well. Now, my wife is quite bright, too. So those two are brilliant, and I'm forceful. But I'm becoming gentle. You know, I tell everybody I'm tough, I'm resilient, I'm full of venom and vigor, but I'm precious and sweet, gentle, and I'm a Christian man, a Christian husband, and a Christian father, and a Christian grandfather. And that's the highest calling you can have, is those latter things. So we started Life Languages to help people develop character, to help them communicate, and to help them to be effective in all their relationships. And we've taught these at Dallas County Sheriff's Department, Dallas City Fire Department. We've taught them at hospitals. We've taught them at Lehman, Law Enforcement Management Institute of Training down at Sam Houston State University. We've taught them at TCLOS, Texas Commission on Law Enforcement Education and Standards. We've taught them in churches, foreign countries. We've been privileged to use and help and save all kinds of marriages because we're dedicated to preventing divorce, interdicting divorce, and minimizing the traumas of divorce when it does occur. And from that experience, you know, we've just had lots of, the Lord has allowed us to be used to the degree we've been submitted and humble and being a servant and available. He's used us to save lots of families and marriages and prevent lots of suicides and a few homicides because we have no fear to go anywhere because to die is pain, to live is Christ. So what the heck? You know, I'm now truly brave. When I was in the Marine Corps, I was just crazy. Now I'm truly brave, but I'm brave because of who I'm in the Lord, not because of who I am as a person. My friend Richard needs to say something.
that's a great intro, Sam. I know you'll appreciate that. When
my friend Richard
partners
Brown.
Call each other the wrong name, right?
Right.
Well, Richard. Give us a little bit of background on yourself, okay. Kind of same question, and how you ended up involved with Life Languages, and interested in your perspective as, you know, a relative newcomer to that organization on, you know,
how that's impacting people's lives and why you decided to go in that direction.
Okay. Thanks, Brad. Well, my background, I was also military right out of high school. I was Air Force. And after the Air Force, I was very privileged to start a financial services career, 22 years in management, and then 20 years in sales with my own clients. So this month, actually, I'm transitioning from over 40 years of financial services to starting to work with life languages. And the question might be, why life languages? Well, one of my passions and what I've always tried to do is to give back to community first. Brad and I have worked together through the chamber, and you know the how much I love this community of Farmers Branch. And as part of the Farmers Branch Chamber, I've been able to lead a number of work areas, and I lead a networking group, and communications is real important. Next year, I will complete 40 years as a member of Toastmasters International. And one of the things that I've recognized personally is that sometimes my wife, Connie, and I, we don't always communicate on the same level. She looks at me like maybe I'm speaking a foreign language. I recognize sometimes in the business community what I think the client may want, I've misunderstood, and I may not communicate effectively. And having known Fred and Anna for the past 10 years, I've been very impressed with life languages. And here we have a communication analysis tool that individuals, couples, families, businesses can use to be more effective in whatever the goal, whatever the relationship, whatever their objectives might be. Because life languages can bring an individual profile tool to the website, the communication analysis tool, and then we have a number of programs that we can bring out there in workshops. So where I am today after 40-some years in financial services, Brad, is I'm excited to take almost 40 years as a communicator through Toastmasters, 25 years part of the Farmers Branch Chamber of Commerce, and to take the successful programs that Life Languages has developed here and around the world and to be part of that organization and marketing. That's what I'm excited about as we go into 2011.
Excellent.
You know, and the communication tool we have, it measures seven different styles of communication, but everybody has all seven. You know, everybody has the kinetic two languages, which are mover and doer. Doers are trustworthy, predictable, they love to do the same task over and over. They're excellent employees. Movers like to bring change. They like excitement. They like to be assertive. They're ambitious. They're standard bearers. They're always trying to change themselves and everybody around them. That happens to be my first language. And my second language is an emotive language, influencer. They're always trying to convince people of things and encourage people, motivate them. They make great salespeople, great evangelists. But everybody has all seven of them. And then the responder, which I'm not as high in as I, but I'm becoming higher in by working at a degree. But they're the sensitive, nurturing, compassionate, caring people. And it's the primary language of the pastors of our local churches if they're less than about 300 people. Mega church pastors are not necessarily responders.
Let me ask you a question about how people communicate, whose responsibility it is. So if you have a, give you a, for example, in our business, we have family caregivers or we have professional caregivers with their senior clients. You know, the clients may not feel good. They may be struggling with pain. They may be struggling with depression. Can this work on a one-way basis?
Absolutely. If your caregiver's working, given some instruction, say, we developed some people within your organization, namely yourself, and they could train these people, take them like to a four-hour orientation or two-and-a-half, three-hour, five-hour orientation. When they go in, they can pick up immediately on the signs that are there, the body language, the words, the way the place is even decorated possibly, as to what is the communication style of that elderly person. And what you'll find is you will not have conflict and diversity issues and gender issues and those kind of problems if the person you're communicating with feels like you care. Mm-hmm. And that means that you can connect and respect them effectively. If they feel that you're connecting with them and you're respecting them effectively, they are going to like you. And the responsibility for achieving that is whoever's the most mature. And the goal is never to be right. The goal is to be righteous. Now, you can be right and righteous, but you can be right and unrighteous.
Right.
You can be ignorant without being arrogant, but you can never be arrogant without being ignorant. So the character qualities, and so what we teach is character qualities. And I will tell you, we had my mother-in-law live with us for 10 and a half years. We knew her profile. We profiled her before she was, well, when she was like 70. And she lived with us 10 and a half years. And it was such a godsend for us to know what her communication style was, because we could speak to her filter to meet her needs, to ignite her passions, to help her stay in positive character mentality. Mm-hmm. But if we had dealt with her different than how God created her, would there have been conflict with her?
We, you know, I teach a course in relationships, managing challenging relationships, and one of the things that we always underscore is that you can't change somebody else's behavior or attitudes. You can only change your own, and you can't change the relationship without changing the dynamic. And so that's what you can do. You can't change that other person, but you can change yourself.
Well, when Anna's mother moved in with us, she was mad, she was angry, and she was bitter. Her husband died at 69 of rheumatoid arthritis, and he spent his last 10 years primarily in VA hospitals and rehab centers. And she just was exhausted, and she was mad and bitter. By us speaking to her in accordance with who she was, which is Ephesians 4:29, let no communication proceed out of your mouth other than that which edifies and builds up the other person. By the time she departed to go with the Lord, she had become sweet. Now, we found out that if she watched certain kinds of TV a lot, she started getting mean again. So we kept her kind of on a diet of things that feed the soul. Because the only thing she's going to take to heaven with her is her spirit and her soul, her heart, will, and emotions. And you all are tied into the elderly. See, we also begin to work with her, and I just had a tremendous experience with an elderly person, our spiritual mom, who I think is 94, if I remember right. But anyways, we began to say to her, you know, do you feel like you've slowed down physically? And she said, well, what do you think? I've got this walker. Think I'm ready to run any foot race? She was real direct. She was like me. She was a mover. That's why my wife married me, because she met me and it was family. Then as soon as she realized I was like her mother, she wanted out. That's why she left home at 17. So we began to say to her, you know, God uses us as we slow down physically and somewhat mentally to be intercessors, because there's no limit to how much we can pray, even if we are paralyzed. And so she began to develop a prayer life, and she began to develop a list of people to pray for. So as she got older, she one day said, you know, I'm doing more good now that I'm older than I've ever done in my life. I was over with my spiritual mother-in-law, who's believed this and studied this for years, and who's just saved my wife and I in many ways, her and her husband, and brought us out. And I walked in, and she had her eyes almost closed, and she was lying there in the bed praying out loud. She was saying, Father, I just pray that you'll bring just a great revival to this world. Lord, let it start with any church that you want it to be. But she says, do a good work in the Baptist, because I just really love Baptists. And then she went through Presbyterian, Lutheran, Catholics, Church of Christ. Then she said, and Lord, look after my spiritual son, Freddie, and help him to be a good man and a better man. And thank you for his wife, who's done so much for me and so much with. And she started going down. She prayed. I stayed in her room for an hour with her where I was there. And during that whole hour, she was praying out loud and naming people and naming institutions and asking for the glory of the Lord to come down and thanking God, saying, now, God, I just don't like this pain. I'd like for you to take it away. But it sure does remind me to pray. So she was giving glory. So I believe that we were able to help her in her latter years, because her communication style was that of a responder-doer. Mm-hmm. So in terms of her first two languages, it means she's sensitive, she's nurturing, she's compassionate, she's a rescuer. she's rescuing people now by praying for them. The other thing about her is she's a doer. She just is always doing. So she prays all day long and all night long probably.
Let me go back to Richard for a minute. Richard, were there, I know you and your wife have been through this. Were there any surprises when you went through this process?
That's a loaded question, because every couple in their communication sometimes has surprises, and you might find that when you have stress times and you have problem times in your relationship, sometimes one or the other speaks in a way that you look at that person and say, where are you from? Didn't you hear me? Do you understand what I'm saying? And what I've recognized, because Connie and I have been blessed to be married also 45 years, what I've recognized is that Connie's main language, and I'll make a comment about the languages, her main style is responder. My main style is influencer. If she's in a particular language, and I have a strong language over here, trying to communicate, we're not on the same wavelength. Sometimes you hear someone say, we're just like peas in a pod, and understand each other's thoughts. Well, I think in our marriage sometimes Connie will say, where are you coming from?
Yeah.
You know, didn't you hear me?
Right.
So the languages are real important. There's not any one that is better than the other, because we have all seven. But through Connie's profile, her seven, through my profile, knowing my seven, there are times, I mentioned the stress and the other things that relationships go through, I can move between languages. The term we call is crosstalks. How many languages do I have to cross over before I'm finally communicating with her on the same level? And that's real important to a couple, but it's also real important to the families here. We talk about what you do at Griswold and the home care, but what about family members that have to help make those decisions for those parents? What if they could communicate better? Would it make the decision process a little bit easier? So it's an incredible profile analysis tool, communication, that helps us to recognize what language we're in at the time. And if we know that, then we can move between the languages and be more productive in our communication.
Excellent. Thank you. We are running a little bit short on time, but as you're talking, the question that occurred to me, and I'm going to toss it back to you to kind of give a piece of advice to our listeners, but when you have a relationship with a, say, a family caregiver and a loved one, it could be a spouse, it could be a mother or father, you've got basically a 1 in 7 chance that you both communicate in the same language. Mm-hmm. And given that our audience hasn't been through this, I wonder if you could give a piece of generic advice, acknowledging the fact that most people don't speak the same language, or at least not exactly the same language. So when you're caring for a loved one, given the fact that you are probably speaking different languages, what advice can you give that person that's providing the care to try to maximize the communication and to create harmony in that relationship?
Well, I want to give a brief answer, but I'd say the first thing, if they chose to, would be to contact you through your website or us, however they can, and take the profile, because until you know yourself, you can't control yourself. And unless you can control yourself fully, you can't give of yourself. So it's knowing yourself so that you can control yourself, that you can fully give of yourself. And when you know yourself, see, like, for instance, I'm really pretty good at judging height and weight. How do I do it? I judge your height against my height. I judge your weight against my weight. If you know your own communication style, your own character strengths, and your own passions, and your own filter, then you have a measurement to judge and consider what other people are. That the word judge has some harshness, but to consider what others are. But the most important thing I would say is this. He who is, or she who's most mature emotionally and spiritually, has the least need to be right. And so therefore you're freed up to be righteous. And the second little nugget is, give up on expectations. Mm. Expectations prove to be disappointing most of the time. and that, and at this point, it causes resentment. And resentment leads to anger, anger to rage, unless you deal with unforgiveness and learn how to know yourself well enough. And then it ends up as a root of bitterness, which defiles many. Mm-hmm. And we're a nation and a world of bitterness. We have a book about to be published on the language of terrorism. And really, it's not so much about Muslims. It's not about Columbine or Jonesboro, where those kids killed each other. It's about the fact that people with lots of disappointed expectations have lots of resentment and anger and rage, mm-hmm. and they are filled with the root of bitterness. And they're going to destroy people. Mm-hmm. So I think it's all about being righteous.
Thank you. Good advice. Fred, and unfortunately we're out of time. I know that you have made some recent appearances on television, and we're going to post links on the website to those. But if somebody from our listening audience wanted to contact you, how would they do that?
Well, the simplest way would be to call Richard Brown, 972-406-1313, 972-406-1313. The second way would be to go to our website, which is lifelanguages.com, lifelanguages.com. And Richard's a good contact. I'm a decent contact. He's an outstanding one.
Very good. Yeah. Well, gentlemen, thank you for being here this morning with us, and we appreciate the time.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
It's our pleasure.
Now we're gonna transition to Sherry Ingalls. Sherry is with Senior Focused Relocations, and Sherry, let's get started the same way. Just give us a little bit of background on where you're from and school and education. How'd you get to where you are now?
Okay. Well, I'm originally from East Texas. I grew up in small towns in East Texas, and it was just considered neighborly to help others, and working as the marketing representative for Senior Focused Relocations allows me to do just that, and I really enjoy it. I went to Stephen F. Austin in Nacogdoches and have a degree in home economics that I guess my family might say I've never used, but I have cooked a lot. It seems like I have two daughters, and my husband passed away in August, but we have two wonderful girls. They're both in college, and that's about it.
So tell us a little bit about Senior Focused Relocations, and how did you become aware of them? How did you join them? And then just give us a little background on what
okay.
you all do.
Well, Senior Focused Relocations is a senior move management and licensed moving company. And the first question most people have for me is, what is a senior move management company? And basically, it really is just what it says. We do everything involved with moving. We work only with senior clients and their families, and we help people downsize, we sort and organize, we can do floor and space planning, we pack, move, unpack, we do the setup. I tell them we do everything but live in it for them. Mm-hmm. But basically what the way the business got started was Michelle Parchman is one of the owners, Sandy Nauta is the other. But Michelle's grandmother had lived at her home for a very long time, and she called a family meeting and announced to her family that it was time for her to move and that she needed some help. And Michelle was more or less elected to do that. She and her grandmother, Ethel, had always been very close. So Michelle took it upon herself to do the research, and she found places that she thought her grandmother might like to live, and they visited each of those three. And her grandmother chose one, and then Michelle worked with her grandmother to downsize the household goods and decide what would be taken. She did the floor plan for her grandmother and the packing and had everything labeled for the movers when they came. So her grandmother was so impressed, she told all her friends at the new Unity that all she had to do was pick up her purse, get in the car, and be driven to her new home. And she started volunteering Michelle's services on the weekends. Michelle had a full-time job selling. She was a sales rep at the time. And she quickly became booked every weekend. And this thought was in the back of her mind that she would really enjoy doing this type of work. And eventually, she talked to Sandy Nauta, and the two of them decided to start the business together. And we're now in our sixth year of business. I've been with them for a year and a half. And we are now the third or fourth largest senior move managers in the nation.
Wow. Yeah, yeah. So I'm guessing that this turned out to be a little bit more complex than Michelle anticipated in the beginning.
Well, I will say Sandy and Michelle are amazing businesswomen. They are, they're just really, I can't think of the word other than awesome, amazing. They are very organized. They have a very specific system that is used in this process. We are constantly complimented on our crews that go out, and they are all trained by Michelle. And I think that the two of them sat down before starting the business and came up with a very specific business plan and have followed that religiously. And, you know, everyone in the company just has a strong desire to help seniors, and we love working with them.
Nothing like going through it with your own family first.
That is very true. And I think that's something that's important, because one of the things we hear from people when we get the calls, we go out, and I think one client that I had said it perfectly, that she called and said, "Can you help us? My parents are moving, and we're paralyzed. We don't know what to do." And it is a very emotional as well as a physical process of moving. But we deal with clients who have lived in their homes for 30, 40, 50 years or more, and they have accumulated lots of treasures. So it is overwhelming to them when they have to think about, what am I going to take with me, whether they're moving to a condominium or a retirement community, assisted living, wherever they're going. They have to downsize, and that is the hardest part of the process, I think.
What strategies do you use with a loved one to get them to part with their treasures?
Well, first of all, we find out. First, I will say that no matter who hires us, and many times it's the children who hire us, but the client is always the senior adult. We find out what they really treasure. And obviously they can't take everything with them. But one thing that we suggest is maybe they want to take pictures of some of the things they can't take, or they want to gift it to some family members or friends. Because I think we all have things we don't want to part with. We all have things that we don't want to part with, but we will if we're forced to. And, you know, well, unfortunately, many times we are forced to do so when we're moving to a smaller place. And so I think taking pictures and the gifting is a really big part of it. They love giving it to their children. And for the children, I tell them, you know, please don't reuse what Mom and Dad want to give you. Go ahead and take it. And then that doesn't mean you have to display it all the time or anything. But one thing that's really nice about our job, I think, is that many times the grandchildren are thrilled to get things from their grandparents, and they have a really special meaning to the grandkids.
What do you think, and what surprises people about this process when you're working with a family? Is there anything I think everybody would believe this is a daunting process, but are there things that surprise families when they start going through this process?
I think just the size of the process, because, I mean, we often have people who call us and want to move that week. You know, if we can handle it that week, that's fine. But sometimes, you know, if somebody's moving from a home where they've lived for a long time, you have to allow time for the downsizing and sorting, organizing. Many times they want to have an estate sale, which we don't do, but we can refer them to people. So the time would be one thing. And then I think the family dynamics come into play many times. because the children often work or they come in from out of town. They may not live in the same town, and they come in and want to get everything done in a hurry, and mom and dad dig their heels in because, you know, they want to have control of the situation. And so I tell people we're buffers a lot of times between the family members because we can say things that maybe the child cannot say or the parent can't say because we don't have that emotional tie. And I think that's a big surprise for a lot of families, too.
Is there ever a, when you get a client, is the person being moved, are they always already on board, or do you ever get in the position where you have to help the family negotiate with the loved one to actually make the move in the first place?
Well, we work strictly from referrals, so, I mean, they are typically on board. Very occasionally we'll have someone. We really encourage the family not to spring surprises on the parents. It's not the way we would to be treated, and so we really discourage that. Even though it may not be a move they would want to make, most of the time people realize it's a move they need to make.
Have you ever had someone change their mind in the middle of the process?
In fact, the first job I ever worked on, the lady, before she had already sold her home, had already signed a contract, and she just became so overwhelmed that, you know, her children were telling her what she needed to do, and the first place she had signed up to move to when she saw the apartment she was moving to, she decided she didn't like it and didn't want to move there, so then she had to make another change, and then she just said, I'm not going to do it. But, you know, the house had been sold, so we had to deal with the reality of that. And I tell people we do a lot of hand-holding because it is a difficult process, and we realize that. And it is a big change for people.
Nothing like trial by fire in your first case, right?
She's such a lovely lady, though, and I still go to see her all the time.
That's great. On the other side of this, you've been doing this for a year and a half. Is there a particular story that just touched your heart that you could share with us?
Gosh, there's so many, because I actually did this before with my own company. But I think that there is a couple I interviewed at a community that we had moved, and they're just such a lovely, sweet couple. And I think just getting to know the people that we move sometimes, it just warms your heart, because so many times, you know, moving is a hard job. It's nasty in the summer. You're sweating and you're hauling all these boxes and furniture. And I mean, there are just days you think, why am I doing this? And then that person comes up to you and says, thank you. I don't know what I would have done without you. I couldn't have done this by myself. And the family's so appreciative of what you can do that, I mean, it's just like, oh, that's why I'm doing it.
Mm, that's great. Have you had any cases where you've got people that are hoarders? Have you seen any of that?
We see quite a bit of that. And the thing that I tell people, too, is that that's a difficult situation to deal with, truthfully. But that's their comfort level. It may not be mine or yours or someone else's, but you have to go in very gently with that person. You can't just go in and force someone to change overnight. So we have to be very conscious of who we're dealing with and what their comfort level is. And another thing that we have to look at is the safety, and I think that's probably something y'all deal with in your business,
yeah,
too,
yeah.
Because you don't want to go into a home where there's a pathway through there. And, I mean, I have been out on appointments occasionally where, you know, you do come up on something like that, and then you
have
to
out a clean house or something.
Yes. But fortunately, that's the exception rather than the rule. But, yes, we just have to deal with that very, very carefully. And they have to gain our trust, because we're not going to go in there and just start telling them what they need to do. That's not the way we operate. And even if that was the way we operated, I think they would immediately say,
yeah,
no, thank you.
It's not happening.
So for our listeners that might have a parent that they feel is on the verge of needing to move, what advice could you give to that person in terms of how to open up the conversation and what kind of process to go through to move in a direction that they know they need to go but maybe mm-hmm. haven't had that conversation yet?
Well, I think they have to be very gentle in the way they bring it up and not be accusatory of presenting it, that this is what you need to do. I think the parent needs to have some input. When we move people, I think the parents who feel they've made the decision are so much more receptive to the move, wherever it may be. And if they can make it a family adventure or family fun thing where they can go out and visit a few places. I mean, you don't want to take mom and dad around to 10 different places. But if you can narrow it down like Michelle did with two or three, four, then I think that's a great way to approach it and go at different times, make an appointment, and also go unannounced so that you can really find out about the community. And listen to what your parents have to say, too, about it, because they're the ones who are going to be living there.
Right.
And that is one thing that we do try and remind the children, that you may want to take the blue sofa, but maybe that's not where mom sits all the time. She likes the red chair. So mom's one who's going to be living there, and let's honor her wishes.
Excellent. Good advice. Thank you. And Sherry, for listeners that might want to contact you, what would be the best way to do that?
The best way to call us at 972-596-2468. Or you can contact us on our website, which is a long website name, but www.seniorfocused, and that's with an ED, relocation, with an S on the end, .com. SeniorFocusedRelocations.com. And I did want to point out a couple of things, Brad, that we are different than regular movers in that we do a lot of things they don't. First of all, we work only with seniors, but we also do the downsizing, sorting, and organizing, which is a major part of moving. And then we do the floor and space planning. And one thing in working with seniors, probably we're all guilty of this, but because we work with seniors, we see it, that we try to take too much into a small space. So with the floor and space planning, that's one way we can really help them so they don't take too many things over there that won't fit, because that's one thing people always ask is, if I take too much, will you bring it back? And I say yes, but we're going to charge for it. So I think that's something important to remember. And then that we not only do the pack, move, and unpack, we actually do the complete setup, which means we handle hooking up all the electronics, we hang flat screen TVs, we hang all the clothes in the closets, the dishes in the cupboard, we even make the beds for them.
Get the VCR DVD player to stop flashing 12 o'clock.
Yes, we do.
All right.
In fact, most of the time our clients go to lunch or they go to Bed Bath & Beyond to buy a new bath mat or whatever while we're doing the work.
Very good. Well, thank you again, Sherry, for being on the show with us.
Thank
Sherry
you for
Engel,
having
Senior
me.
Focused Relocations. And Sam, I'm going to turn it back to you in Atlanta.
Thank you, Brad. We appreciate it. Fred, Richard, Sherry, I thank you for being our guest today. Great conversation, great subjects. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Joining me today in Atlanta, Georgia, is Judy Darby. Judy is the Executive Director of Elder Care Connections, and she touts herself as a geriatric care manager, and I will expand on that and say with a unique specialty in that that discipline. So I'm going to begin by asking Judy to just tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us where you're from and your education. How did you get to be where you are today in your profession?
Thank you, Sam. And first, let me say thank you for giving me this opportunity. One of the problems I so frequently see is the general public does not know what is available for our chronologically gifted population. I think that sounds so much nicer than the elderly. I grew up in a small town in southeast Georgia called Lyons, next door to Vidalia, where the onions come from. In those days, they were nothing special, and that's absolutely amazing to me to see what has happened. But I would sort of correlate that to what has happened with services for our chronologically gifted. I went to University of Georgia, eventually transferred to Georgia State University here in Atlanta, have an undergraduate degree in psychology and a master's in counseling and psychological services. I began to realize as an adult that my grandmother had a tremendous effect on me. I think she must have been one of the original home health care providers. This was many, many years ago before agencies existed. She took care of her husband, my grandfather, for a good 7 years until his death. And after that, she spent much of her time living with other elderly folks and taking care of them, as I say, before agencies existed. But with my education, I took a number of pre-med courses and eventually went into disability case management. Mm-hmm. Did that for about 20 years, all along the way thinking of the influence my grandmother had had on me. But there was not a lot of emphasis on geriatric education when I was there. Fortunately, things have changed dramatically, I'm happy to say. As the good Lord would have it, in my opinion, I was contacted about 12 years ago by Joe Kilpatrick, CPA. Joe had been attending a meeting of the American Institute of CPAs. They had a task force giving a report, and the question had been, many CPAs are having aging clients asking for services, which CPAs aren't trained to provide. What do we do? So the bottom line, and obviously I'm making this very brief, was team up with some kind of social worker type person and together provide those services. So 12 years ago, Joe Kilpatrick and I established Elder Care Connections. I am a certified case manager. As I mentioned, Joe is a CPA. As a certified case manager, I had prepared budgets for many of my clients, but I did not feel that I had the financial background I needed to provide financial services. So I worked in Joe's CPA practice for a year to provide myself with more of the financial background. I started working with some of his clients and have branched out to many others. In fact, I do work with other CPAs. If I have a client who has another CPA in place, then they are not asked to change. They continue with that person. What do I do as a financial case manager? It may be something as simple as writing checks. Perhaps they have macular degeneration, which means their vision is greatly impaired. Many of my clients have some form of dementia. Obviously, the most common is Alzheimer's. I work with people who have various forms of illnesses that prevent them taking care of their financial matters. Because my background is counseling as well, I am watching for other aspects of the aging process that they may be experiencing. I consider a part of my obligation to keep a list of persons who may provide services that I can't. For instance, when I work with someone, I'm going to make sure all of the necessary legal documents are in place. I'm not an attorney. I don't do that kind of work. But I would oversee their getting them. We are going into the time of year when we begin thinking income taxes again. I am not a CPA. I cannot do an income tax return. I do know what is needed for an income tax return. I know how to organize it so it is presented to the CPA so that he or she only has to do the return. But getting back to my everyday work with some of these folks, I do, as I mentioned earlier, something as simple as writing checks, reconciling bank statements, on up to I have one client who has no relatives other than two second cousins in California. So I am power of attorney for everything. I'm executor of her estate. With any client I work with, I am constantly on the look for how their affairs generally are being handled. I am scrutinizing every bill that comes in, every Medicare or secondary insurance, EOB, or explanation of benefits, is looked at very carefully to be sure that they aren't paying bills they should not pay. Obviously, we all know there are many scams mm-hmm. against the elderly. There are situations where it's not necessarily a scam. It's just not a good idea. I had one lady with whom I worked who had Parkinson's. She was on a walker, had trouble even motivating with the walker. Mm-hmm. She had a call from a telemarketer who managed to sell her a travel package for $700, $800. You can't say it was a scam. He was on the telephone. He didn't know what her condition was. Mm-hmm. She obviously needed the attention. And this is something that we need to be aware of with our aging population, is they need to be heard. They need to have interaction with others. She fell victim to this, and she signed up for this program. It took 4 months, but I eventually got her money refunded. So many of the people with whom I work are unaware of all the changes in our world. They are still living in the 1950s, 1960s, thinking business is done the way it was back then. Mm-hmm. They get very angry if they have to phone someone and put up with all these automated systems. They cannot do that. So that seems like a simple thing for me to do, to handle those things for them. But it keeps their level of agitation down a great deal. One thing I would say, Sam, that is so important, and I say this to any family member or any caretaker, have some comic relief for both of you. And I'm thinking of one day I was working with one gentleman. I'd been with him for several years. He had Alzheimer's to the point that he slept most of the time, same caretaker with him most of the time who knew me. And I had finished my work one day, and I realized he was awake as I was leaving, so I went over to say hello to him. And his gruff voice, he said, "What's the matter? Did you work just half a day today?" And I said, "Well, if I stay any longer, I'm going to spend more of your money." He said, "Go home." And we all just had a good laugh about that. He was sharing in the laughter. It is important that they share in the laughter. Yeah. So I try to, when I'm working with these chronologically gifted, yes, we must be serious about a lot of these financial matters. But I also try to have some lighthearted moments that I can involve them. That's not always possible. Some of my clients are bedridden, and they are, as I mentioned earlier, victims of Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. They are beyond the point. But if I can, we try to introduce a little humor, make life a little more pleasant for them.
You know, it seems to me that as you described your specialty, that it might be proper, and you correct me if I've overstepped my boundaries in changing your title, you might be a geriatric financial counselor with a subcategory of a geriatric care manager. Is that a reasonable?
That would fit. Obviously, I don't go for that long a title when I try to explain to somebody what I do. I would lose them with all that. But that is a very good description of what I do, Sam.
How do you bridge between the financial discipline that you have and then the actual care aspect of your client, of someone delivering care or their need to have care in the home?
I would assess what their needs are first, and I am trained in doing this. I am trained in doing consultations as well as the financial case management. So I would make a list of what I perceive their needs to be. If they are able, I will go over this list with them to get their input, and that is very important to me to hear how they react to my suggestions. If I can't deal with them, I, if possible, deal with a family member.
Okay.
But then I keep a list, as I mentioned earlier, of services, providers of services for the people with whom I work.
It seems that with your specialty in the financial aspects of the elderly, that they are entrusting you a great deal of responsibility and authority in their lives. You've got the pen, so to speak, and you're also making at least recommendations about who's going to be there with them on a daily basis. How do you manage those delicate situations? I mean, I guess what I'm asking you is, how do you gain their trust?
Key question. How do you gain their trust? And I will tell you something, a little story that illustrates that. Several years ago, I met a psychotherapist who dealt primarily with the elderly. And when she found out what I do, she was thrilled. She said, "I can't wait to give your name to some of my clients." She called me a month later and she said, "How do you ever get any work? I told these people about you. I thought they had come to me with the most personal of matters until I mentioned their money. And then I realized just what a personal issue that is." And you are so right about the trust aspect. When I begin working with someone, that is a very important thing for me, is to establish that. I will always have a meeting with them initially at no charge to talk about what is it you think you need. Obviously, I'm going to have some suggestions, but I don't go in and say, "We will do A, B, C, D." It's very important to involve them in the process of what I am going to be doing for them. I try to be very gentle when I suggest other things to them. To the extent possible, I put myself in their shoes. Obviously, that is limited. But I am studying at all times their reactions, their choice of words to me, and I react to that. But building this trust is something that can be done only over time. And that's the key. And I am aware that I don't go in and try to take over. I wouldn't want that, and I don't do that. So I gradually build the trust. But you're right, it's overwhelming to me at times to think of the responsibility that these people place on me, the dependency that they have on me. And I will say that is another key thing. I try to find where they have some independent functioning, and I build on that to the extent that it possibly can be built on without being damaging to them. But building the trust is something that I work very hard at, and will even ask people at times, "What is there that I could do that would remove any barriers mm-hmm. to our working together?" And I listen very carefully. If they, most of them don't give me answers, but if I get one, I listen very carefully to that.
Well, I think that just the sincerity in your response probably bridges that gap as well as anything. And I know that I, like you, are in the senior business, and it's time, and it's sincerity, and it's performance, and it does take time to gain that level of trust that they will come to you, as you said, with a matter of financial that's more important to them than anything, it seems like.
That's right. Yeah. And I would also emphasize your word performance. If you tell them you're going to be there at a certain time, be there.
Yeah.
If you tell them you're going to do a certain thing, do it, or have a very good reason.
Yeah, it's real funny. I'm gonna tout my own horn a little bit. I tell my caregivers that if you want to know how to keep the boss happy, always do the right thing. And then I look at him and say, I know you're not going to, because you're human. You're always going to say or do things that you are, that you intend to do, and you have good intentions and whatnot, but you don't do it. And then I tell them, I said, but there's one brand new invention out there. High technology, one thing that you can do, you can use, that will eliminate a lot of this. And they look at me, okay, it's a telephone. Pick up the telephone, dial the number, tell whoever that you're supposed to be with what's going on. I said it will cover a multitude of sins if you do that. And it's true. It's that, you know, we all want to do the right thing and always want to be the best, but very seldom are we. And the best thing you can do is to own up to that and tell people and say, hey, I messed up, but here's what I'm going to do.
Absolutely, Sam. I agree with you. One aspect that I didn't mention of what I do is I obviously go to my clients in their space of living, whether it's their home, whether it's independent living, assisted living. So I am driving around in Atlanta traffic a lot. I also have problems sometimes gauging how long I'm going to need to be with someone.
Sometimes you can't gauge it.
You're right. So it's a constant juggle of schedule for me. But I do exactly what you tell your caretakers. If I am running even the least bit late, if I am caught in traffic, whatever it is, I call the client and explain to them in great detail. And it doesn't make them happy, but they do try to understand, I think.
Well, at least in Atlanta, everyone is certainly aware and sensitive to traffic. So if you let the individual know, hey, I did the best I could, but I'm here in traffic, they will accept that. They do understand. I doubt that there's anyone who lives in the metropolitan area of Atlanta that has not been hampered by traffic at some point in their lives. So
absolutely.
I understand that.
Well, this is another aspect, Sam, that you bring up, is flexibility is so important, not only on their parts, but on my part, because they have doctor's appointments that get changed around at times. Or I have some clients that I work with every Tuesday afternoon, for example. And if a doctor's appointment is scheduled then, I will try to be flexible and change my schedule, knowing how difficult it is to get a doctor's appointment.
Right.
So it's a two-way street. Yes, they have to be flexible with me, but I have to be flexible with them as well, and respect. And I think that's another key word. You mentioned the word trust. Yes, but let's also add respect to that. And that's not just their respect for me. It's more my respect for them as individuals.
Yeah, I think Fred in the earlier broadcast said it. It's called servant, and you know, if someone were to really want to know what I do, I serve the seniors in our community. That's what I do. I'm a servant, and if I view myself as a servant, then that's going to do nothing but reap benefits for my organization. And I'll tell you, I'm a servant, but I'm a selfish servant because I serve to gain something, and that's conditional love, unlike what Fred was talking about, but that's what this is all about. You know,
absolutely. And along my way of my education, I had a professor one day say that giving is a selfish act, and I didn't understand that for a while until I thought through, but it's exactly what you're saying, Sam. when we give, we get back. And I think when you are working in the field that you and I both are, if you don't get back, if your personality is not such that you receive that kind, then you don't stay in the field.
That's right. You know, there's this old saying, you can have anything in the world you want if you first help enough people.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell us, where do you, for the lack of a better term, where do you practice? Is there a geographical footprint in the Atlanta area, or is there not?
Obviously, I am a little limited because of the absolute time of getting from place to place. That's downtime as far as my business is concerned. But I work primarily in the Decatur area, up to anywhere in Atlanta, Buckhead, Roswell, Marietta, Alpharetta. I have one client up in the Cumming area.
Okay.
To the extent I can, I obviously try to schedule everyone in the same area in the same day. But that really is a, you laugh, and that is a laugh. It doesn't work like that.
I've tried and tried. I've tried for 5 years. It just doesn't work.
No, no. That gets into that flexibility I was talking about a little earlier. If you try to work around their schedule to the point you can.
Yeah. Judy, for those that are out there and are intrigued by your sincerity and what you have to say about your services and could you give them a piece of advice as they start a process of exploring what their, first of all, what their needs are, and then who and what may fulfill those needs?
First of all, I want to emphasize what you're saying. Begin the process. Make plans. Do not leave it to circumstance. Do not be in the position of making crisis decisions. Mm-hmm. Rarely is a crisis decision a good one. To avoid this, get the information. I'm not saying make definite plans. It's mm-hmm. very difficult because you don't know what the needs are going to be. But you can have the information. You can know what the services are. You can know who provides the service. You can have phone numbers handy.
Right.
A good source for a lot of that information, and I'm giving a plug here, are geriatric care managers.
That's okay.
Most geriatric care managers, just like any other profession, specialize. But all of us are very good about keeping up with who provides what service, having that information available at our fingertips. I'd be delighted for anyone to contact me if it's not a service I provide. For the elderly community, I can find someone who does.
Well, why don't you go ahead with that and tell our listening audience how they may contact you.
My company is Eldercare Connections. The phone number is 770-455-8832. 770-455-8832.
With that, Judy, I certainly want to thank you for being our guest. It has been a pleasure to meet with you and to get to know you a little bit. I look forward to working with you in the future, and hopefully we can find a reason to get together on this show again.
I would certainly hope so, too. And again, thank you, Sam, for this opportunity.
You're quite welcome. That's it for today. I want to thank our listening audience for bearing with the length of this show, but it was good content, and we certainly didn't want to cheat anyone of any time. I want to remind our listeners that if they wish to listen to a rebroadcast of this show, they can do so at eugeriaradio.com. And in closing, as we always do, if the youth of our nation is its greatest national resource, it goes without saying that the seniors of this nation is its greatest national treasure. Thank you and have a blessed day.
Eugeria Radio is sponsored by Griswold Special Care and broadcast live from the Business Radio X studios.